Three gunshots echoed through the House of Hutchinson funeral home on a sweltering June afternoon in 1977. Reverend Willie Maxwell collapsed at his adopted daughter's funeral, blood pooling beneath the pews. Hundreds of mourners stampeded through doors and windows in blind panic. The shooter, Robert Burns, calmly handed his gun to police and confessed immediately. Yet this wasn't a simple case of murder. It was the violent culmination of 7 years of mysterious deaths, insurance fraud, whispers of voodoo, and a community's simmering rage. What made this story even more remarkable was the woman sitting unnoticed in the courtroom, Harper Lee, author of To Kill a Mockingbird, who had spent a year investigating what she hoped would become her triumphant second book. Instead, her manuscript vanished into one of literature's greatest mysteries, leaving behind only fragments and questions about truth, justice, and the stories we can never finish telling. In 1926, Alabama Power flooded 44,000 acres to create Lake Martin, the world's largest artificial lake at the time. This drowned landscape became the backdrop for Willie Maxwell's transformation from respected preacher to suspected serial killer. Maxwell was an ordained minister, known for powerful prayers and biblical knowledge, always immaculately dressed despite working at a rock quarry and running a pulpwood crew. In August 1970, his wife, Mary Lou, was found brutally beaten in her Ford Fairlane, her body showing extensive injuries, including a partially severed ear and strangulation marks. Though the car appeared parked rather than wrecked, Maxwell claimed he'd been home sleeping. His neighbor, Dorcas Anderson, initially contradicted his alibi, but mysteriously changed her testimony. Maxwell was acquitted. Most chillingly, he had purchased a $15,000 life insurance policy on Mary Lou for just 25 cents shortly before her death, and his payment request was dated before his murder indictment. This pattern repeated with horrifying regularity. Maxwell married Dorcas, insured her heavily, and within months she was dead. His brother, nephew, and finally 16-year-old adopted daughter, Shirley Ann, all died under suspicious circumstances. He collected on 17 policies, totaling substantial payouts. When Shirley's sister screamed accusations at Maxwell during the funeral, Robert Burns pulled out a Beretta and ended the Reverend's life before hundreds of witnesses. Tom Radney aspired to Southern Camelot. His family photographed like the Kennedys at the Montgomery State House. Born in 1932, he learned compassion from his mother, Beatrice, who taught him to deliver food to neighbors while witnessing his father evict a sharecropping family after the father lost an arm in a cotton gin accident. His political career began absurdly when his 1962 House victory was redistricted away while he celebrated on the Gulf Coast. 4 years later, facing H.H. Runt O'Daniel's viciously racist campaign featuring cartoons of barefoot black men and blood-red warnings, Radney brilliantly distributed the offensive materials to both black voters and white country club friends. Many were embarrassed by such crude racism, helping him win with an overwhelming Macon County margin. Yet politics proved dangerous. Death threats, one reading, "Roses are red, violets are blue, you're dead, Radney, and your family too," drove him from office. He later ran for lieutenant governor, campaigning across all 67 counties, but lost, lamenting that Alabama wasn't ready for the politics of reason, not race. What made Radney's involvement fascinating was his dual role. He had represented the Reverend for a decade, helping him collect insurance money from suspicious deaths, before defending the man who murdered him. Harper Lee saw echoes of her own father. Both were country lawyers, state legislators, Methodist lay leaders, and Masons. But where Atticus Finch represented moral clarity, Tom Radney embodied something more complicated, a liberal who defended an alleged serial killer, then switched sides to defend vigilante justice. Alabama courthouses had evolved from judges under oak trees into brick buildings with Greek Revival columns, architectural symbols of civilization. In one such courthouse, the trial of Robert Burns would pit Tom Radney's silk against District Attorney Thomas Young's sandpaper. Unlike most trials that resemble warmed-over grits, this promised genuine drama. Radney's audacious strategy, keep Burns's criminal record and confessions from the jury while emphasizing Maxwell's reputation as a voodoo practitioner and Burns's Vietnam trauma. The trial began September 26, 1977, with an all-white male jury Radney believed would sympathize with his righteous murder argument. From opening statements, the attorneys clashed. Young portrayed Burns as a one-man lynch mob, while Radney admitted Burns killed Maxwell, but argued he wasn't himself when doing so. Radney masterfully shifted focus to Maxwell's alleged crimes, introducing voodoo into proceedings, putting the victim on trial instead of his client. The explosive moment came when Alfonso Murphy testified that Maxwell had offered him cash, a car, or property to kill Shirley in. This transformed State versus Burns into the People versus Willie Maxwell, casting the murder victim as villain and the shooter as vigilante hero. Defense experts testified Burns suffered from transient situational disorder and acted on irresistible impulse. Radney cataloged accusations against Maxwell before pleading humility as a simple country lawyer, asking jurors to weigh Burns against Maxwell on the scales of justice. After 5 hours, not guilty by reason of insanity. Burns was sent to Bryce Hospital, but released within weeks. When Marion Pittman Allen found Harper Lee at the Horseshoe Bend Motel in 1978, Lee mentioned working on something about a voodoo preacher, her elusive second book. Born Nell in 1926, she grew up in Monroeville wearing overalls, wrestling boys, and years ahead academically. Her best friend was Truman Capote, who appeared like a changeling next door. They became inseparable, flying kites, staging baptisms, writing stories together. After abandoning law school 6 weeks before graduation, declaring a writer is someone who writes, Lee moved to Manhattan at 23. Following family tragedies, she returned to New York determined to memorialize her childhood. For 5 years, she struggled in a third-floor walk-up without hot water. Christmas 1956 changed everything. Friends gave her a check reading, "You have 1 year off from your job to write whatever you please." Within 2 months, she completed Go Set a Watchman. Though rejected, she soon wrote another manuscript that became To Kill a Mockingbird. Working with editor Tay Hohoff, she made crucial changes, shifting to Young Scout's viewpoint and transforming Atticus from complicated segregationist into moral exemplar. Days after submitting her final manuscript, Lee joined Capote investigating the Clutter murders in Kansas. While Capote's flamboyance struggled to gain trust, Lee proved invaluable, documenting scenes, connecting with wary townspeople. She deeply disapproved of his fabrications in Cold Blood, privately lamenting that Truman's having long ago put fact out of business had made me despair of factual accounts of anything. After Mockingbird's phenomenal success, Lee withdrew from public life, overwhelmed by fame and struggling with her second novel. Her father's death in 1962 removed both her caretaker and Atticus Finch's real-life model. Her struggles intensified. A 1965 hand-burning incident while frying chicken made friends wonder if her writer's block had manifested physically. Her drinking worsened. Neighbors recalled late-night visits where she'd appear drunk and despairing, once begging for vodka after throwing 300 pages down the incinerator. By 1977, everyone who'd helped create Mockingbird was gone. Then, at a Democratic convention party, Tom Radney told her about Willie Maxwell's strange life and shocking death. Lee recognized a true crime story and headed back to Alabama. Yet, as Janet Malcolm noted, there's an abyss between reporting and writing where many get stuck. Finding a protagonist proved impossible. Maxwell was underdocumented. Burns played one dramatic role, no lawman solved the cases, and even Radney seemed not an entirely reliable narrator. Despite her sister Louise guarding her privacy and daily writing routine, progress stalled. Lee felt trapped between her agent wanting pure gore and autopsies, her publisher wanting another bestseller, and her own desire for a clear conscience. When Capote died in 1984, Lee could only whisper, "My old friend." By 1987, she abandoned the Maxwell Project entirely, concluding she'd collected enough rumor, fantasy, dreams, conjecture, and outright lies for a biblical volume, but lacked sufficient hard facts. By the 1990s, Harper Lee had become literature's most famous one-hit wonder. She stopped drinking and writing, though her letters grew more buoyant as she began accepting public recognition. After her 2007 stroke, Lee returned to Alabama permanently, settling into assisted living. Nearly blind and partially paralyzed, she still received fan mail about the Maxwell case. In 2009, she responded that her reporting had produced a mountain of rumors and a molehill of facts. Harper Lee died February 19, 2016, at age 89. A year later, her estate contacted Tom Radney's family, who recovered his briefcase, in Lee's possession since 1977. Inside were newspaper clippings, case records, and court transcripts. Among these, a single page of Lee's typed notes. Her estate remains sealed, all literary assets unpublished. Perhaps the unfinished manuscript is its own truth. Some stories resist telling because they contain too many contradictions. A liberal lawyer defending both alleged serial killer and vigilante murderer? A community knowing evil but unable to prove it? Lee spent a decade chasing facts where truth was measured in rumor. She sought Atticus Finch's clarity in a world offering only Tom Radney's moral ambiguity. The greatest mystery wasn't who killed Willie Maxwell or why Lee met her finished. It was recognizing that some truths are too tangled to fit neatly between covers.